And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Big Cats dance to own samba beat in Sao Paulo 1-2-3 podium party. Van Dorn vulnerable and vanquished in peculiar Peloton pack palaver. Buemi negates knuckle nightmare in never say die point performance. And Maserati points famine continues as Rossiter rues another ruinous, wretched race ruckus. Welcome, everybody, to the Races Formula E podcast. I'm Jack Nichols, and I'm delighted, well, I'm fairly happy to have with me the races man in the paddock, Sam Smith, but I am delighted to have Sam Bird, the Jaguar TCS racing driver and podium finisher last time out in Sao Paulo, with us as well. You're both called Sam. I've just realized this is going to be an issue. Bird, we will start with you. Thanks for joining us. What a weekend in Sao Paulo.
Yeah, thanks, Nichols. amazing event, I think, by Formula E. I think it was really well received. Fans loved it. I think we, as drivers, gave them a really entertaining race. And for Jaguar as a group, not only Jaguar TCS Racing, my team, but for Jaguar as a group to lock out the podium was just amazing. Everybody was so over the moon. Everybody back at base who's worked so hard, this is just reward for all of their hard work. And you know what, Jack? The last couple of races have been tough and challenging, to say the least. But this is a huge step in the right direction for not only myself, but for the whole team.
It's been threatening, Smith, hasn't it, the whole year?
It has, yeah. I think I just want to point out as well to our dozens of listeners that those headlines are written by me at the top of the show. We got a few nice comments in the paddock about them, so I just want to take credit for those first off. But
no, and to be fair, I always say that you've done them as well. I never claimed
to
have written them.
Yeah, no. I mean, in terms of Jaguar's performance, yeah. I mean, we all knew it was coming. It was just a question of when it was going to come. Don't forget, their season kind of didn't really kick off until Riyadh. They had such a difficult time at Mexico City, and then we all know what happened at Hyderabad and then Cape Town too, with extraordinary circumstances. But they came through and they exploited their potential and their package, which we all fully expected. And the hope now is, of course, for Sam and the team, is that they can kick on, use that momentum, and really get stuck into what is, I think, the big story, is the sort of concertina of the point situation, because Wöhrlein hasn't scored big in the last two races and Dennis hasn't at all. So there's a nice title plot thickening there. And and Sam and Mitch are obviously very capable of joining that party very soon.
Well, yeah, that's the question, Sam. Are you in title contention?
I don't see any reason why both myself and Mitch can't fight for this title. We both have the machinery and we've both showcased great pace pretty much every single track. Okay, Mexico I didn't really drive, but every single time the car has hit the track, we've been threatening the top three or four positions in every session, in qualifyings. So I don't see any reason why not. It's going to need a huge effort. It's going to need no mistakes, because obviously the Porsche drivers had an amazing start to the year. Pretty much, you know, everybody thought that they would go and win every single race. Now they've had a difficult patch. They'll come good again, but we need to make hay while we can, while we're on a good vein of form. And hopefully Berlin will be kinder to us this year than it has been over the last previous couple.
Was there anything different for you and the team in Sao Paulo, or is it like sort of just luck?
No, it's not luck. It's definitely not luck, because every everybody's been working extremely hard, and we believed in our philosophies and what we were doing.
I think my point was more, were the rest all bad luck? You know what I mean? And that just didn't affect you this weekend.
Well, we learned a lot from Saudi. And then, you know, look, India was my mistake. India was completely my fault. I can't really say anything else about it, Jack. It was a poor effort. A poor mistake from an experienced driver that shouldn't happen. I think South Africa, I was disappointed in. I'm still disappointed in what happened in South Africa, because I don't think that should happen in our level of motorsport. But look, it's happened now, and it's past. I can't change it. But I never stopped believing in the team, and to be fair as well, I didn't stop believing in myself, because I know that the speed is there. Like, I've shown it all year, and so has Mitch. And this was, as you guys have said, this was going to happen at some point, but it's so brilliant that it was a 1-2-3.
Sam, do you want to add anything to that?
I think it's funny. Motorsport's one of those things where momentum is key. I mean, especially in Formula E, because it's so inconsistent anyway, and it is so easy to get into troughs. I mean, you know, Sam's been in a couple in his, well, more than a couple probably, but other drivers have
been.
So
have you, to be fair.
but and there's no way of digging myself out of this one, especially if people knew the recording shambles that we had prior to this starting. But no, I mean, it's Formula E is, I mean, it's a cliche now, but it is so brutal in terms of drivers occasionally making mistakes, and it's so public in the sense that if you do make a mistake, you're going to hit somebody or something, you know, you're going to hit a wall. You haven't got huge runoff zones or gravel or whatever to go through. You're in the wall, and Sam has suffered that. And I think the interesting thing for me is how drivers deal with that and fight back from it. And in Sam's case, you know, he's had to do that a few times in his Formula E career. Some sink, some swim. We've seen that. You know, drivers have come and gone. XF1 drivers have come and gone because they've got into that pit and not been able to come out. So, yeah, I think all power to the drivers that do come out of it, because it takes a massive amount of concentration, dedication and steel to make sure that you do come out of that. And you know, Sam's race, just going into Sam's race a bit, you know, starting 10th and coming through, I had my eye on him during the race behind Vern, because the key to this race, and we're going to come on to that I think shortly, was obviously to sit in the draft as much as possible so that you could manage your energy accordingly, and Sam did that predominantly behind Vern, but others too. And then when it sort of, the race freed itself up and you got this Evans and Cassidy breakaway, you know, Sam was able to join that by clearing, I think, Stoffel and then Da Costa in quick succession. And then it was all about this dash to the flag after this brewing, pot-boiling peloton style of racing, which was extreme at Sao Paulo. Probably the most extreme I've seen in Formula E. Whether that's good or bad, we're going to debate that, I'm sure. I tend to think it's good. I enjoy it. And I think it adds a big strategic element upon all the other strategies and setup and all the other challenges the drivers face. So it's multifaceted racing. And yeah, Sam did it. But interestingly, when I spoke to Sam in the pen, media pen after the race, he touched on the fact, and also on TV, that, you know, he was conservative with Hyderabad in mind. And I guess, Sam, that was inevitable, wasn't it, in some sense?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, we as a team, and Jaguar as a group, this is the first year that we've had a customer team. We've never been in a position like that before, where there's the opportunity to get lock out a podium. And with India in mind, can you imagine if I'd been the one to try and slide it down the inside of Nick and got it wrong and collected all three cars, for example? It just couldn't have happened. So, you know, it was about scoring the best points I could for the team, which on Saturday was a third place.
How so? We'd heard many times in Formula E. I remember the first one being season 7 Valencia, I think it was, where everyone's like, you don't want to lead this race. If you lead the race, you're not going to win. and Jake Dennis led from the front and won. And then we've heard it many other times, you don't want to lead this race. And it's never really quite materialized. It was so dramatic, Sam, in Sao Paulo. Sort of, why was that? I mean, we had people, I think it was Da Costa, went from third to first on the road. You know, people were desperate to not lead the race in a way that we've not seen it quite that sort of literally before.
I think that the toe effect in this Gen 3 car is far more extreme than we saw in the Gen 2 car. The way that you gain extra speed.
And was that anticipated, or did that just sort of, did you learn that as the season progressed? Because you don't, obviously you're not running them in a wind tunnel and stuff.
Well, no, so cast your mind back to race 2 in Saudi, and I was pretty keen to get into the lead in front of Seb. Now, I was told on the radio in Saudi after six or so laps, you're 0.5% up on Seb. And I just thought that was down to general pace and being good around Saudi. So I then overtook for the lead and tried to build a gap. But by doing that, I'm then pushing the air. I'm punching the hole for everybody else. And it became so much harder to hit the targets when you're leading than when you're in second. And then it's even easier in third and fourth and fifth, especially if you're grouped together as a group. And we got the first glimpses of it there. So, and then Mitch felt the same thing the following day when he led in Saudi on day two there. And we've kind of learned from that, but not had the opportunities in India and Cape Town to deliver a better race plan for many reasons, obviously. And this was the first time that we could really learn from our experiences early doors. But it is so extreme. The way that the speed of the car is a lot higher when you're in the toe, which then means that you can lift earlier and then recuperate energy earlier and then recoup more. So not only are you gaining in a straight line, but you're recuperating more because you're coming from a higher speed and lifting earlier. So it's basically a win-win.
Have we ever seen this before, Sniffer, in like motorsport, like a bit at the Indy 500 and some ovals? Maybe you sit in the draft and save a bit of fuel, but never anything. This is like kind of a new way of motor racing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is in a sense. I mean, you're right in saying that oval racing has that, but obviously doing it on a street track is a completely different challenge. I mean, just to give you a few additional reasons why we had that race. I mean, a lot is to do with the configuration of the track, the nature of the track, long straights, pretty staccato, high braking corners, conjoined with the highest ever percentage that was needed for saving. It was around 35% of saving needed. You know, the previous highest of this season was Cape Town, which was 19.8. So it was a really tough energy saving race. Don't forget as well that the season started with 41 kilowatt hours of usable energy, and that was reduced to 40 for Riyadh as well. So all these factors combine to make it this uber saving race where you really didn't want to be leading the event. I mean, Stoffel Vandoorne said much of that when he was leading throughout the first phase of the race as well. So I mean, it goes back to what the championship wants. Does it want to have this kind of racing, which is inherent to what Formula E should be? And obviously it gives great messages to the automotive strands of the manufacturers that are in the championship. But occasionally, I think it's good from a personal point of view. I like it. I think it's great. But you need variety. You also need the odd flat-out race, if the circuit allows. I mean, London's the difficult one, really, because the nature of that track and the sort of tight confines of it often makes a flat-out race with the amount of usable energy available. So it's a kind of a real balance, a sort of getting the sums right in a way. But I thought overall, I mean, the fact is, if everyone's talking about the race and how great it was, and you've got a few detractors, which there were, everyone's talking about
it. What were the detractors? I didn't really hear much.
Yeah, we ran a piece today, actually, which I spoke to Antonio Felix da Costa and Stoffel Vandoorne, who obviously, you know, I think they quite enjoyed the race, but they didn't get the result. So it's one of those classic examples of whoever you ask, you know, who finished on the podium is going to enjoy that type of racing. I think the guys near the back probably didn't, because they knew they were sat in a draft, and you got this concertina effect, and you... Again, the nature of the track, we have these complexes at turn one, turn two, and then was it four and five, where you have these kind of quickish chicanes or complexes. There was the inevitable accidents as people backed off, and it just became a yin and yang sort of thing. So there's good and bad from the competitors' point of view, but from the consumers, from the people watching on TV and the people us at the track, you know, I can count on one hand the amount of times that you've heard whoops of delight and interest and excitement from people in the media centre, and the media centre was alive with enjoying that race, which is great, because the same in the grandstands, and it's great for Formula E that we have this, you know, we have this complex, intriguing potboiler of a race, and it, you know, eventually came down to that last lap three-way shootout, didn't it? So, you know, there aren't many championships in the world that offer that kind of excitement in races.
I'll jump in there, Sam. I've got to say that when the Gen 3 car came out, I was questioning the vehicle, but I've got to say that it has absolutely stood up to what Formula E absolutely needs. We are, at the end of the day, we are the entertainers, the drivers are the entertainers, and our whole point is to entertain crowds and bring in people to come and watch an entertaining form of motorsport. And I think that the car that we have right now is absolutely delivering great races. You know, you look at the last one, okay, there'll be some drivers that are disappointed with the race, but nobody can deny that if you look at it from an outsider's perspective, you can't sit there and say that it wasn't exciting. The same goes for Cape Town. I mean, I watched Cape Town back. It was a thrilling race. I mean, the end, you were sitting on the edge of your seat thinking, is Da Costa going to hold on? You look at the races in Saudi, lots going on, many different plots and twists and turns. You had the Porsches coming through, and it was exciting forms of motorsport. It's not conventional, but Formula E never has been. So I think that the Gen 3 car is really delivering what we want, and that is high-class entertainment in electric vehicles.
I think completely agree, Sam. And the interesting thing is, and I'm genuinely not one to compare Formula E with Formula One.
Oh, here we go. Here we go again.
No, but you won't find me doing that at all. And I never did when there was comparisons with Monaco. It's just a false narrative completely. But interestingly, you look at Formula One now, and my colleague Damien Smith wrote an excellent article on Motorsport, the Motorsport magazine website today, which made the very good point that, and I know you guys obviously work together on Five Live, Formula One is possibly facing one of its less interesting seasons, let's say, if the Red Bull dominance continues, which we expect it will for at least the first half. Whereas Formula E is giving multiple pole sitters, multiple winners, multiple threads throughout its narrative of a season from a championship's perspective, and I'm not comparing, and I'm not going to evaluate either. But it'll be interesting to see if Formula E can harness the great shows it's putting on week after week into actually finally breaking through to a bigger audience. That's the bigger picture for me, and the hope is that it does, because it's just fantastic motor racing. Has its detractors, always will have, but the fact is, it's just great motor racing. I mean, end of really.
I think what Formula E is doing really well at the moment is it is delivering great races, and it's doing its talking on the track. Formula E, I think Formula One is so slick. I mean, it looks incredible. The paddock looks phenomenal. The grandstands are now always full because certain programs on certain networks. it is a well-run, well-oiled machine. But is it thrilling, and is it super, is it as exciting? I mean, you look at how many lead changes there were in the last race. And that I don't think that would ever happen in a Formula One race. I don't think it has ever happened. I don't think it will ever happen. It might cater for a slightly different audience, and it might cater for a different fan base, but we are delivering great racing. And that's what we're there to do. I don't think it needs to be as slick as Formula One. It'd be great if it was. The teams certainly operate at as high a level as Formula One, given the budgets that we have. And maybe one day we can get there. Maybe that's filling grandstands with 100,000 people. Maybe that's something we can aspire to do in the future. But I think that Formula E has been through not a tough couple of years, but Formula One sort of burst onto the scene again, didn't it, with Drive to Survive, and became uber popular over the last sort of 4 or 5 years because of that. And we were gaining momentum still until Drive to Survive came along. But I actually really feel like, people were judged the Gen 3 car. And now people are coming to realize, this racing's really quite fun. It's quite exciting and entertaining. And I think the Formula E's going back up again.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Sam, just before we let you go, Sao Paulo as an event, what did you make of it?
I thought it was awesome. I thought it was really cool. I'm looking forward to going back again next year. But, we as drivers, we were put on this kind of samba float.
Yeah.
Which then turned into a podium, which was really cool. At the end of the race, the grandstands were full, which is always lovely. I'd love to see more grandstands around the back of the circuit, because most of them, I think all of them, were down the front straight. I'd love the fans to have the opportunity to see us through some of the corners, especially more of the overtaking zones. I don't know whether that's going to be possible. But yeah, amazing fans. I think quite noisy, quite into Formula E. And, when you do a race like really exciting, it'll attract more fans the following year.
Did you get to ride on the giant papier-mâché Jaguar, Sam? And what was it like?
I did ride a giant Jaguar paper. I was quite nervous, actually. When we were on the podium after the celebrations, all of Jaguar came on the podium and we were bouncing around. And you could see Alberto Longo just going, "No, stop, stop." He was like, "No, wait, too much weight," with like 40 people on this thing bouncing up and down. It was great fun, great noise. Like, you really felt a great energy there. I can see why they hold the famous thing down.
Carnival, yeah.
Carnival down. It is quite special.
Awesome. Right. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us. We'll let you go while we talk about Max Gunter and stuff, unless you want to stay and hang around and chat about Max Gunter with us. But we'll let you go. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck for Berlin.
Take care, guys.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Right, Sam Bird has left the chat, so we can say whatever we want about him now. But to be honest, he's the kind of guy you can say it to his face. We haven't really discussed the race winner yet, Mitch Evans. Really solid drive from Evans, and Sam, he's led two races already this season, but then in leading those races, as we kind of touched on earlier, ran out of energy, or then they tried to be sometimes a bit, not too clever Jaguar, but take an attack mode to drop back into the pack, and then they get caught and then it doesn't work out, but finally all executed very well.
Yeah, it was kind of similar in a sense to last season, wasn't it? He came away from the first three races with, I think, 1 point.
He got
a bit more than that in the opening races, although in terms of the way Mitch likes to run races, it was, you know, it was far from where he wanted to be and where the team wanted to be. They turned that around, obviously, last weekend. They've always had the potency to do what they did, to win races. You always felt, if it hadn't been for penalties, if it obviously hadn't been for Sam's error in Hyderabad, Mitch would have been there or thereabouts, and it came to be. It was a well-judged race. He and Cassidy were very, very similar on pace. Cassidy could easily have won that race. I mean, if he'd have got the break prior to when Mitch really kicked on, then Cassidy could have won that race. It was so super close. Interestingly, what nobody really picked up was the fact that Mitch had a massive scare. He had a really strange sound in his powertrain from early on in the race, and it sort of cleared and then came back, and he was very worried on the radio, and his team couldn't trace what it was. So that was something to be dealt with. And I caught up with Mitch actually afterwards and just asked him in a bit more detail about this issue, which gave him a few palpitations, shall we say, as the race went on.
Halfway through the race, you said you had a bit of a problem with the cars. I mean, with the powertrain, you felt tightened up or something. Was it a warning light or something you saw?
No warnings, but I could about probably after the first safety car, I could hear something in the powertrain. Just, you know, it was like a note change. Almost something was like not grinding, but it wasn't, something wasn't happy. I've never noticed that before, and it just sort of progressed from the start, the first phase, and it kind of got a little bit worse, and it sort of just stabilized. And I thought at one point I was derating, but I wasn't. I think it was just maybe I was in clean air, so I was not getting the tow effect. But it was kind of hard to know. But I was quite convinced that there was some sort of problem. Luckily, it didn't get any worse, and it didn't hinder the performance. So
yeah.
So Evans then came through to take the win despite those concerns. We had Sam Bird saying, you know, there's no reason he and Mitch now can't be in title contention. And what I will find interesting is that intra-team sort of scenario between Bird and Evans, because they are back to being very evenly matched after maybe a sort of blip year last year for Bird. Are they going to have to, do they need to kind of back one driver if they really want to get in the championship fight, or is Formula E not that straightforward?
I don't think it is. I think if you start orchestrating things, as DS to Cheetah seemed to prove every second race at times, didn't they, in some of their campaigns, it gets complicated, it gets messy, and people get confused. They're probably best doing what they've been doing so far. I mean, there will be people that will say, well, you know, Sam Bird owes Mitch one after Hyderabad, but racing doesn't work like that, and nor should it. I think it'll be interesting if they both start to get big points and haul themselves up to the up into championship contention with the Porsche and Andretti drivers. I mean, just looking at the table now, actually, Bird is sixth and Evans is ninth, and they're separated by 5 points. So no, they will continue as they are doing and pick up as many team points as possible. I think in I think the championship will, there will become a definitive pattern, I think, probably around Jakarta time, when we get into that summer period of then Portland and then two doubleheaders to finish the season. That's, I think, when, if any, big discrepancies and gaps will start to play on the minds of James Barkley and Florian Modlinger, etc., to see if they can actually prioritise a driver. But it's way too early for all that. I mean, the, you know, the championship isn't really forming particularly yet, and it's all bunching up. So, no, and you know, I made a point in a piece I did after the race that actually, whereas the Hyderabad situation could have become toxic if grudges were held, actually, I just sent, speaking to both Mitch and Sam, and you know, Sam was the first to go and heartily congratulate Mitch after the checkered flag, which was great. I actually think that their relationship seems to be stronger in a sense, in a way, after that Hyderabad incident, where, you know, Sam was obviously left with no alternative but to profusely apologise, which he did. So I think because they're so honest with each other and seem to be honest, very honest as a team, I think that will probably work to their advantage. But who knows? I mean, we've said that before of many drivers, haven't we? And they all seem to fall out and squabble over each other. But I just get the sense that, you know, they're two ultra professionals, two pretty, well, very experienced now in Formula E terms. And I think they'll be able to look after themselves.
Second in the race was Nick Cassidy. So a Jaguar powertrain 1-2-3. Only once before, I think, as a manufacturer locked out the podium, which was Mercedes with Venturi and Mercedes EQ in
Berlin.
I think they finished in Berlin. They finished 1-2-3-4, I think.
They
didn't
did.
They? So that's the only time it's happened before. So Cassidy was in there in second place. You mentioned him a moment ago. Is he a, I mean, well, I guess he's obviously a title contender, but I never see him in the races. I feel like I never see Cassidy until even when he was leading in Sao Paulo. You sort of didn't really see him, and then suddenly you're like, oh, he's going to get a podium. That's kind of how it's felt the last three races.
He's stealthy, isn't he? Which is, you know, which is how you win championships. The big question for me might just be, is he doing what Van Dorn did last season? Is he the sort of, you know, the silent assassin who can win a race but also win a title? I mean, he's the last three races, that's exactly what he's doing. 2 second places and a third. I think there's only one race he's not scored points this season. So that fits in with that sort of vibe. We're seeing the points being split a bit less so far, I think, with, you know, we got generally four Porsches, four Jags, and a couple of DSs really taking the big points at the moment. So yeah, he's a stealthy, consistent Kiwi, and I think he's got a real platform now where he can really manage to stitch a challenge together for the title. You'd have got mega odds, wouldn't you, on Cass winning the title at the start of the season?
Yeah.
Because he just wasn't been talked about. But I think his hype will go on and on. And obviously his teammate, Sebastian Buemi, who's quick, but isn't getting the points for various reasons, which probably just segues us nicely into his latest trials and tribulations there, Jack, does it?
Yeah, well, you just do it. You don't need me on the podcast. You can just segue yourself into everything. I like it. Yeah, Buemi, I couldn't believe he'd come back to finish 10th. It's one of those where I didn't really realize it until I think the next day, and I was looking at the results because, you know, that's what I enjoy doing. But he got absolutely, he was dead last, wasn't he, after the opening lap or whenever he had his shunt?
Well, very similar to Cape Town, wasn't it? You know, he was last.
Yeah, how did he finish fifth in Cape Town? He got absolutely cleaned out on the opening lap.
I know, extraordinary. But this time he had a bit of pain to deal with because he smashed his hand in a slightly less dramatic than Robin Frein style. But I saw him afterwards, and he had one of his knuckles was the size of a Cadbury's cream egg. I mean, yeah, other Easter based confectionery is available. But
mini eggs. I love mini eggs.
Yeah, well, it was a mini egg sized abrasion or bruise or whatever you call it on his I think his right
hematoma.
Who was he driving for? No, I mean it was
he's filling in for Andre Lotter in Jakarta.
It was a nasty injury. I know he had an x-ray. He saw Dr. Francescini at the track, then he flew home on Saturday night, had an x-ray the next day, yet to hear what state his hand's in, but it was heavily bandaged. So hopefully he's going to be all right, because in a few weeks, he's got Portimao WEC, Berlin Formula E, Spa WEC, and Monaco Formula E as a quadruple header. So he needs to be fit and ready for that lot, that's for sure. But great drive, you know, adrenaline kicked in and he came through, grabbed a point. But again, when I spoke to him, he's super disappointed because he knew that with the car that he had, the Jaguars were obviously predominant in that race, and he should have got his first podium of the season, I think, and sort of got a little bit of payback for that Hyderabad podium that was snatched away from him so unfairly. And I had a chat, Jack.
Okay, I thought that's remember, what you were going to do.
While I remember my slick link into his interview, I had a chat with a still slightly agitated Sebastian after the race.
No, he cut the chicane on his own.
Yeah.
So the rule says if you cut the chicane on your own, you need to stop, and then you can go again, which he would have lost the position. He went flat out all around. He didn't give the position. And then the next corner, he stopped in turn four. Stopped, like stopped.
Yeah.
So I got behind and I snapped my hand. Should not even have been there, you know, because if he would have respected the rule, would have been behind.
So if he hadn't been cleaned out on the opening lap in Cape Town and had that sort of concertina accident in Sao Paulo and had that harsh penalty in Hyderabad, he'd be right up there, Buemi. I know everyone, all the drivers can say ifs and buts and whatever, but yeah, I think Buemi's on some really strong form. Let's go for our top two in the title next. Pascal Wehrlein, 18th on the grid, had a grid drop for hitting Buemi in Cape Town, so that's why he was down in 18th, but he only qualified on the 8th row of the grid, I think. I think he was due to be 15th or 16th, depending on whoever won the final. Came through to finish 7th. There was one point I thought, Wehrlein's going to win this here, and then it all kind of disappeared because I think he still had to take his attack modes, but solid enough drive through the field from Wehrlein?
Yes, he did it again, didn't he? He did it in Hyderabad as well after his free practice accident, and I don't know what happened in qualifying. I never got a satisfactory explanation. I don't think he made a massive mistake. He
hit the wall a bit at turn.
Oh, did he?
Exit of turn eight. Okay. Not enough to break the car, but enough to lose time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he was. I know he's disappointed with the one lap pace of the car through the sims he did in free practice too. Just didn't happen for him. But he made up loads of positions on the first couple of laps, and then he had this damage to the floor of his Porsche when Jake Dennis inadvertently hit him. This was inspired, let's say Dan Ticktum inspired knock-on, and Dennis delivered the contact, which we'll mention in a bit, I think. And that damaged his floor a bit, and he did take it as an unusual strategy in that he took both of his attacks really late, which I didn't quite understand. But anyway, I think really it was the floor damage that probably hampered him a bit, and he was stuck behind his teammate Da Costa and came in behind him. So, yeah, but again, the fact is when you don't qualify well and you're fighting the car a little bit to get points as he did, as per Hyderabad, then again, I'm sure looking when we get to the end of July and we're at Excel and we're looking back on the championship, it might just be that these performances are the ones that got the necessary points to, you know, for him to possibly be Porsche's first champion. But yeah, again, a long way to go, but it's just got the feeling of that those kind of up against it performances where it might just be in Pascal's favour at the end of the season.
Yeah, Dennis second then got wiped out by Dan Ticktum. I don't really think Dennis was necessarily coming through the field anyway, but still called him a plonker.
Yeah, I mean, you know, is there a more uniquely British insult than that? I mean, I've not heard that for years, but yeah, quite amusing, really. I mean, to be fair to Ticktum, he did apologise to Dennis later on, which was obviously good and obviously needed because it was just a big screw up, unfortunately, from Danny. He got onto the non-rubbered in part of that surface, which you not felt it or saw it, Jack, but the surface in that sort of Sambadrome area was weird. It almost felt like a sort of you know, one of those I know you're a raver, you know, the spongy floors you get in clubs where you can have a bit of a bounce around. That's what it seemed like. It was sort of painted grey, and it felt that way. It was a really odd surface. And interestingly, I spoke to the Hankook guys on the grid, and they said that the track surface there was 10% cooler than it was on the other surface that was mostly used on the track. So, you know, there was a bit of strategy at play there in terms of the tire temperatures too. But yeah, I mean, when you got off the rubbered in bit, it was, you know, you were straight to the scene of an accident, as Tictum proved. So, you know, broke Dennis's rear suspension, then he smashed into Wöhrlein. Very messy. Second time in three races that Dennis has been turfed off by others, so he rightly felt a little bit slighted, to say the least. And yeah, he sort of unleashed a bit of he vented a little bit at the end, which was, you know, entirely understandable in the circumstances.
Stoffel Vandoorne looked like he was kind of back in the mix, but starting on pole position, and it just looked as though, I don't know, it just looked as though he sat at the front using all of his energy. Everybody else said, yeah, fine, do that. And then he had no energy. Like, it seemed like really simple from the outside. Was there anything more complicated to it?
I don't think so, no. I think he just got ultimately compromised by being in front and dictating the pace too much. And that lack of...
didn't want to kind of give it up, I suppose, was seemingly... Like, the team and he, or he, seemed to think that was the best way to go, right? Because then we saw, as we discussed earlier with Sam, all the Peloton stuff of people bailing out of... you know, desperate to try and lose the lead, whereas Vandoorne didn't seem too fussed.
Yeah, it was a curious one. But, you know, he's been quite conservative in races. I think what he's doing is he's applying what he did last season, and I'm not sure that's entirely always the right way to go, but the fact was that he was dictating the pace too much. The lack of toe effect just really hurt him, and you know, Sam, as you said, mentioned it before, in Gen 3 it seems to be detrimental much more if you are the one punching a hole in the air, and when you add it up lap after lap, it can be very detrimental to the energy consumption, obviously. So yeah, I mean, he where did he finish? Was he sixth in the end? I think Vandoorne was sixth.
Yeah,
wasn't he?
Sixth. Yeah,
sixth. So he's kind of having these results of, you know, been between sort of sixth and ninth, I think, generally this season. So it's kind of, he's consistently scoring points, but they're not big points. So he's
And normally they're coming from the back of the field, and he gets up to eighth or seventh, and you go, not a bad drive. Whereas this one was, you know, he just keeps kind of naturally finding himself in this mid points position.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter whether he starts at the front or the back.
Yeah, and he's 66 points off Wöhrlein now. So in all reality, he's not going to defend his championship. They've got a quick car, and it is improved since the start of the season. The team's doing a very fine job in exploiting it. But Wöhrlein never looked like getting into the top three, did he?
No.
As well. So it just didn't really work for DS Penske on that occasion. But I mean, great qualifying lap, by the way. You know, Stoffel's qualifying performance was terrific and a big improvement on what he's got so far. So he'll take away from Sao Paulo enough, I think, to be winning races this year. I actually doubted that. I think I said I doubted that DS Penske would win a race, and then it was immediately proved wrong by Wöhrlein's win in Hyderabad. I expect Stoffel to win a race or two this season, and DS Penske to come back fighting. But you know, when you look at the points table now for Stoffel, it looks like very, very difficult to defend his title now.
Da Costa finished fourth, having been very quick in free practice. He was sort of back on, because again, the Cape Town win came from outside the top 10 on the grid, only the second time that's ever happened in Formula E. What did you... He was sort of in the mix, but also not quite really. And he was running at the front, but then as everything kind of settled down, he got cut adrift. And when Bird overtook him for third, Bird sort of disappeared up the road, and Antonio was just left there pootling around fighting with Wöhrlein. Never really in contention, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it all hinged around that crucial mistake he made at turn one, where he locked up and then had to stop.
Oh, yeah.
That really compromised his race. I think it was looking good up until then. He would have been in that fight for for at least a podium, if not challenging Mitch, I think. He was quick enough, ran a really nice race, was cute in the aspects of banking energy and just being in the right positions, and then just grabbed the break. And, you know, I think from the outside, it's quite difficult to understand just how, even now, how difficult it is, even though we don't actually see the manifestation of lockups. These things are still happening. It's still complex for the drivers to brake. I mean, people know that there are no rear brakes, traction brakes on the car, but there are at the front, and it works in conjunction with brake by wire. And then you've got the front MGU. It's extremely complex, and it occasionally catches drivers out. And unfortunately, it did for Antonio there, and it cost him. The frustrating thing was that, unlike Max Gunter, he had to, you know, he stopped. He did what Scott Elkins told him to do, and stopped before rejoining, and it cost him two or three positions. And from there, it was always going to be difficult. He probably did the maximum he could of getting fourth place. And it was a bit of a rueful Antonio that I spoke to after the race, and he told me about that locking up episode into the Turn 1 complex.
And to be honest, I thought I was playing it perfect. You know, I could see what was going on. I know what everybody wanted to do, and I had a plan, and I thought I was doing a perfect job. I was slightly down on energy to Mitch, but I knew when he committed to go, he was going to burn that, and I would have been there, and I would have gotten it back. So honestly, close to a perfect race, except for my mistake in turn one, where I went straight, and we decided together with the race director that if you cut a chicane, you have to come to a complete stop to obviously not gain any energy. And I did that and went from second to seventh, and that obviously compromised my race a lot, man. And, yeah, it sucks, because I mean, I'm not saying I would have won the race, but I would have been in that little group there in the top three. And then I got Jev, and I still thought I could have caught the group, and I locked up again. So to be honest, there's a few things we need to understand why. Like, we're fixing most of our problems, but there's still a little road to do, and really to make sure that these things never happen again.
So Da Costa is still fifth in the championship, but only 4 points off Jake Dennis in second place now. So he's very much not out of the title race. If we consider anyone to be in the title race, then they're all in it. You see what I mean? Like, because if you think Wöhrlein's lead of 20 points isn't that much, which it isn't actually. Because actually, now I think about it, how many drivers? Well, yeah, Dennis. Oh no, it's not 20 points, is it? Well, my maths is terrible. 24 points of Wöhrlein's advantage up at the front. But you've got five drivers now. The top five are separated by less than a pole and race win's worth of points. You know, so you know, Da Costa could get ahead of Wöhrlein in one race in Berlin if he took pole and won the race and Wöhrlein didn't finish. So even though Wöhrlein looks like he's got that little advantage, and he does, it's not insurmountable by any stretch.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, when you look at the hierarchy, it's definitely Porsche and Jaguar. But of course, that's eight cars. I mean, let's call it seven, because Andre Lotterer is having an absolute stinker of a season, isn't he? I mean, he's just gone missing, unfortunately. And he will, literally, at Jakarta, of course. But I think you look at Buemi, who, you know, he's got one of the top cars, and he's on the cusp of that, isn't he? He's just behind Sam. He's on 42 points. Sam Bird's on 44. They are the two that, and obviously Mitch Evans too, who's slightly further behind on 39. They are the three drivers that you would say at the moment should be able to penetrate that top three after a succession of races. The unknowns for me, just going back to DS Penske, are them, because they just seem slightly inconsistent in applying their package, let's say. And I think Vern and Van Dorn to a lesser extent, but certainly Jean-Éric Vern, you look at his last three races, his points have been very good. The win, obviously, in Hyderabad, the second place in Cape Town, and then he got the fifth, I think, didn't he? Fifth place in Sao Paulo. So he's got some consistency now. But it's going to be super close. I just wonder if it's going to be one of those seasons where, although to a slightly lesser extent to the 2021 season when De Vries won it in that mad season, if it's going to be a bit more like that, which would be great. You know, it's always nice to have a proper storyline, isn't it, of two or three going for it. But I just get the feeling that Verline, Dennis, Cassidy, Vern, DaCosta, Bird, Evans, possibly Buemi, but certainly that seven there that I mentioned are going to be will win races and naturally thrust themselves into the top headlines of the championship battle.
Right. Let's just cover off a few things real quick. I'll cover off Robin Frijns because he's nice. Returned to Formula E, did the World Endurance Championship race a couple of weeks before in Sebring, said he was kind of fine there, but basically was struggling with getting up to speed in the Formula E car. Because when you think about it, he'd done like one day of testing in Valencia, two practice sessions and a qualifying session. And that was actually it. That was all of the running he'd done. So all the other drivers have four extra races compared to him. So he said just for him, it was the issue for, as far as he was concerned, was just being a bit rusty in the new Formula E car. Well, not even rusty, because he never really did any driving to get the rust on. And Sam, the Brazilians, what happened to them? A shame.
A shame, yeah. Not much for the home crowd to shout about. Lucas de Grassi clipped the wall unfathomably. I don't think I've seen an accident like, I mean, there have been accidents like that, but so
Buemi,
stark was
2017.
Yeah, but just an odd one hitting the apex like that. I mean, I don't know if it was just a lapse of concentration. I'm pretty sure it was, which begs the question, was Lucas too preoccupied at the weekend with everything that was going on off the track? I mean, I actually didn't speak to him. I couldn't get anywhere near him. There was about 1,500 Brazilians all over him. But I just got the sense that he was pulled all ways last weekend. Did obviously loads of great promotional work for his home race, something which he's been dreaming about for the last decade. But I just got the feeling maybe it was all a bit too much. And he did make this mistake in qualifying, which was a rookie error that you're not used to seeing de Grassi make, that's for sure. I mean, that car is challenging, but at least they got a race this time. At least they were on the grid after fixing their rear suspension issues from Cape Town, which saw them withdraw. Of course, his race, he saw some progress. I think he finished 13th in the end, but again, you know, Lucas de Grassi isn't made for finishing 13th position, so a difficult one for him. Sergio Sete Câmara was quick. He should have been, I think, around about 7th or 8th on the grid, but unfortunately got his lap taken away from him for a technical issue which triggered a red flag, which is a slam dunk in the regulations. But look, if it's a technical issue, slightly unfair in a way, but it is what it is. He went down the grid, got his time disallowed, and from there his race was a little bit anonymous, to be honest. I think he had some car damage, and he just sort of ebbed away and finished right at the back. So yeah, a really difficult one for Sete Câmara, and actually Neo 333 in total, really, after Tictum's Dennis outrage.
Right, well, I think we'll leave it there, to be honest. Really great race in Sao Paulo, and Mexico was a bit, I was a bit concerned after Mexico City, maybe these cars won't race very well or something. The first race in Diria was okay, second race was a bit more boring. Since then, it's just hit the roof. Hyderabad, I came off Hyderabad saying, is that the best Formula E race ever? Then suddenly Cape Town maybe was a bit better, but maybe not. Maybe Sao Paulo was better. I don't know. We're being treated to such a great season. And now we head to Berlin in a month or so, a track that everybody knows very well, but that doesn't actually mean they know what to do there, Sam. I think there's going to be a lot of stressed engineers heading to Berlin, because the amount of times I've heard from Jaguar, oh, no, we've worked out what to do in Berlin, we'll be fine this year. Nope.
Yeah. It's really difficult, and of course we just don't know what the new cars mean on that quirky surface and
the new tyres as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That intriguing element, all those intriguing elements, it's going to make it very interesting. DS Penske have always been, the DS element have always been super good over there. Last year, Edo Mortara was superb. We didn't talk about Maserati, but it's probably best we didn't, just for the...
Well, that's kind of... I thought we'll leave the negative story.
Yeah.
So I didn't mention Maserati or Nissan or anyone.
We don't really want to go there, do we? I think they just want to forget all about... Well, Maserati want to forget about their entire season so far and start again.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see who's quick there. I could see... You know, we talked about those title protagonists. I could see a couple of cameos coming maybe to put a few spanners into the title challenge a little bit, and you would think that at some stage Maserati would be among those, and we've seen that McLaren can be quick and Fenestraz too with Nissan. So yeah, it's all to play for, and there'll be, again, as ever in Formula E, so many threads to try and unpick from this great racing.
Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. Pascal Wehrlein leads the Formula E World Championship, and we will be back after his home race in Berlin to discuss whatever happens over that doubleheader weekend. Only the second doubleheader of the season. Looking forward to it. Speak to you then.
The Athletic.